It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's tourism economy is booming. The state's tourism department has released new figures that say Wisconsin broke its tourism record for the fourth consecutive year in 2025, with more than 117 million visits last year, creating $27 billion in total economic impact.
That's over $1 billion more than 2024, which had previously held the record. In just a bit, we'll talk with the UW La Crosse tourism researcher about these state trends and what they can mean for communities and local economies ahead of the busy summer vacation season.
But first, we head to Door County. John Jarsh is interim CEO and chief communications officer for Destination Door County. That's a nonprofit tourism organization representing the county. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be with you and happy Wednesday.
Thank you. What have you been seeing in Door County for visitor numbers and tourism dollars?
Yeah, well, just like the state, we did see a nice increase in 2025, up about 5.4% in overall spending here. And we continue to really see Door County as a place that people love to continue coming to, whether it's again or for the first time. And we're thrilled, obviously, with the numbers and the impact that our visitor economy has on our residents, but also just in general in the way that we are part of the state and the overall state picture, and really the strong visitor economy that we see throughout the state.
What do you think is, you know, driving some of this uptick in visitors, not only to Wisconsin, but to Door County where you are?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things. Obviously, Door County has been a very popular place for folks to come and get away to for a long time. And I think that continued allure of what we offer here, the fact that we're close to so many Wisconsinites, and yet when people are here, they feel like they're really farther away than they might be. Hmm. And I think that helps. Certainly the outdoor recreation, the maritime heritage, all the things that people love about Door County, and the quaint little villages. I think it all adds up to Door County just being a really easy place to get to and a great place for people to come and rest and relax and recharge as they get back to their everyday lives.
But here's the thing. You need a robust workforce to sustain a growing tourism economy. And while tourism dollars were up 5% or so last year, employment was up only 1%. Does Door County have the labor force, have the labor pool to sustain the tourism industry?
That's certainly always been a challenge for us, and it's been something that we focus on year after year and trying to find ways to make sure that our workforce is adequately staffed to make sure that we're providing the service that our visitors have come to expect here in Door County. It's definitely something that we work with our partners on, and our employers are constantly having to work that. Mm-hmm. And we utilize a bunch of different options in order to fulfill our workforce needs here. Obviously, locals, college students that may come from around the state or around the Midwest to work for the summer. But we have also needed to tap into summer work travel programs with international students. You see that in seasonal destinations and actually just travel destinations across the country, mm-hmm. having to tap into that as a source for workforce as well. But it does a couple things. Number one, it helps our businesses stay open because they have the workforce with those. But it also creates a really interesting and fascinating cultural exchange with our visitors and our country and these students that are coming from other countries around the world.
With gas prices the way they are, averaging around $4 a gallon in Wisconsin, do you think tourists will modify their vacation plans at all in response to the cost of transportation now?
That's a great question. We think they may to some extent. Fortunately, Door County historically has not seen as big of a drop off when gas prices in particular have been higher. Again, because of our proximity to so many Wisconsinites, we may be a backup location. Instead of traveling across the country for a longer road trip, they may decide to stay a little bit closer to home and decide to come up to Door County. And so we're well positioned from that perspective. What we don't know, or we are really keeping our eyes on, are spending patterns once visitors are actually in Door County. That's one of the things that we're not quite sure what may happen. Some of the national trends are leaning towards people maybe not spending quite as much once they're in destination. We're we're kind of keeping our eye on that, and that remains to be seen. But in terms of actually people coming to Door County still this summer, we're really optimistic that it will be another great season here in Door County.
And before we have to let you go, how much of your tourism happens during the summer versus the other seasons like spring or fall?
Yeah, so we can break it down by quarter. Certainly May through October are our busiest 6 months of the year. No doubt about that. We did see a nice uptick in the fourth quarter this last year. And to be honest, I think that partly had to do with that Christmas movie that we shot up here.
Oh,
and so we did some things around that and a movie trail. And that, I think, did help to get folks up here during the holiday season. And so, but that May through October time slot has really been a bulk of our businesses. Will make their income for the entire year.
John, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Have a great Wisconsin day.
You too. John Jarsh, Interim President and CEO, Chief Communications Officer of Destination Door County. We've been talking about this uptick in tourism and the economic impact in Door County following a statewide trend for the past 4 years. Now to look more closely at this, we have Tanner Knorr, Assistant Professor of Recreation Management and Director of the Tourism Research Institute at UW La Crosse. Tanner, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so last year, Wisconsin saw 117 million visits, $27 billion total economic impact. What stands out to you about those numbers?
Well, these numbers are huge and definitely mean a lot for the state in general. What I like to see is as these numbers increase, right, that has a positive impact on our reputation as a state, the image, the brand image of people visiting. And I would like to highlight that these overall numbers, right, are divided into three separate categories, right? There's the direct spend just from tourists spending on lodging, recreation, food and beverage. There's indirect spend from the businesses that are hosting tourists. And then also the induced impacts of those employees then spending their money in the areas that they live. So we call this a multiplier effect, which has a lot of really positive benefits for all of these destinations around the state.
Certainly, you can see the ripples there with that impact. What makes Wisconsin stand out among the Great Lakes states when people are making their vacation plans?
Well, we have a tremendous amount of natural resources for people to experience. I mean, here just in La Crosse, we have the Bluffs, which is wonderful for hiking, biking around the areas. And then we also have the Mississippi River and a series of lakes on the other side. So you kind of get the best of both worlds in one location.
Take us to La Crosse for a moment. You've been studying some of the local tourist spots with your students. What have you learned? What are some takeaways?
Sure. Yeah, we were sponsored to conduct research on Lake on Alaska by Bryce Prairie Conservation Association. One of the surprising findings that we found with the class that we led this past spring was that it wasn't only visitors, but also locals who were definitely in support of conservation measures, not only vegetation removal, but also dredging of the lake to ensure that these natural resources that we all know and love are able to sustain themselves for the long term.
Anything surprise you from what you heard from local residents as they view tourists coming into their community?
I thought that the most surprising part of the research was how eager locals were to talk about these issues. You know, and sometimes in destinations, there's a lot of conflict between locals and tourists because tourists bring in a lot of, it's possible for them to bring in a lot of kind of negative aspects to the destination. But I think here there was an overall sense of sharing the resources and ensuring that we're able to use them for the long term.
The state tourism department says that tribal nations have a critical role in attracting visitors to the state. How are tribes contributing to Wisconsin's overall tourism boom?
Yeah, absolutely. And while we don't know the figures, because that is proprietary to all of the tribal nations here in Wisconsin, of course, we do have the casino related activities. But what I would encourage people to look more closely into is the learning about the history, heritage, cultural elements, participation in activities while traveling to tribal nations. I think that we have an interesting relationship with the education around Indigenous peoples and tribal nations here within the U.S. And hearing those stories firsthand, one-on-one, can help to build a relationship and undo some of that past harm done.
Consumers, they're still spending, but we have rising prices that are eating away at people's savings. Looking ahead to this busy summer vacation season, how could tight budgets and high gas prices impact Wisconsin's tourism numbers?
I think it's possible that it's actually really favorable. As the last guest said from Door County, people might be traveling shorter distances, right? So they might want to stay within the state to have those summer travel plans rather than traveling internationally or across the country to experience some of the same types of outdoor recreation activities, but staying closer to home to experience those with their friends and family.
And staying closer to home, you discover more things about your home state, about other communities around you.
Right, because tourists, or being a tourist, right, is more so a mindset, right? It's going somewhere to experience a place for the first time, to experience a new perspective on life. And even if that's a town away, it can really do a lot of positive things to reset for the folks that are traveling from place to place.
Tanner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tanner Knorr is Assistant Professor of Recreation Management and Director of the Tourism Research Institute at UW-La Crosse. And earlier, we heard from John Jarsh from Destination Door County. We've been talking about a new report from the Wisconsin Department of Tourism showing that 2025 was another record-breaking year for tourism in the state, continuing a four-year streak.
Coming up, most doctors use AI in their practice, from note-taking to interpreting test results. Hear how Wisconsin Hospital is navigating this technological evolution.
AI is sort of the opportunity in the best sense to really help patients and their families get the right care at the right time.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The next time you go to your local hospital or clinic, there's a good chance your healthcare provider will use artificial intelligence in some form.
A recent survey from the American Medical Association found that over 80% of physicians now use AI in their practice. That rate more than doubled since their 2023 survey.
The most common uses reported are for note-taking and summarizing medical research, but some use it to assist with diagnosing test results or drafting messages to patients.
We're checking in on how Wisconsin healthcare companies are using AI and what potential benefits and concerns come with the technology in this setting. Dr. Brooke Crotty is an internal medicine physician and interim president for Inception Health, the innovation arm of Frederick Theta Care. Dr. Crotty, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Happy to be here.
Now, that phrase AI covers a lot of ground. It can mean a lot of different things. What are some examples of ways that you're using different kinds of AI at Frederick and Inception Health?
Well, I think about AI as sort of the opportunity in the best sense to really help patients and their families get the right care at the right time. And that does mean in support by the right clinicians as well. AI has been used both within the walls of our hospitals as well as in our remote patient monitoring that we're doing, where we're able to reach into people's homes and connect with them and care for them in ways that we otherwise have not been able to do. But you also see AI being increasingly used directly by patients and families to answer health questions, for example.
Well, let's take that into the doctor's office now. Say I'm there for an appointment. I'm meeting with that clinician. What, as a patient, might I see AI doing in that environment?
The most common thing that you will be seeing inside the clinician's office is ambient scribe technology, basically a fancy term for AI note-taking. You'll often notice that clinicians are focused on screens and the keyboard, and the new AI scribes are able to be unobtrusive, invisible in the exam room, and to take notes and help provide the clinician with a summary of the medical encounter. So what you'll notice there is that the clinician may be looking at you, maybe being more attentive to you and less focused on getting everything down into the documents, into the notes on the keyboard. And what we're seeing now is we're maturing more where we can use the technology more invisibly in the background.
And you mentioned patients might interface directly, or family members might interface directly with some sort of AI agent or something to do what? What would I be interacting with to try to get information directly in that situation?
So hospital and health systems are increasingly using AI agents to help connect with patients between visits. It could be before a procedure, or it could be after hospitalization. For example, as a patient, you may be called by an AI agent who's there to check in on you, ask questions, make sure that you're recovering or doing well according to your care plan. And if anything seems out of ordinary or off track, they can then route that to a human care team member who can then pick up the connection and the phone call. We're seeing this often used now to call and do outreach for tests that you may be due for, but maybe just haven't been scheduled yet, like colorectal cancer screening is a really good example.
One concern people have had, especially in the healthcare field, is that, hey, we see AI hallucinate is the phrase, add something that wasn't there to begin with. How do you watch for that? How do you make sure that isn't interfering with the patient experience?
I think we have to be aware that these are tools and they're not perfect. And this is, I think, even more particularly important when AI is being used without the guidance of a professional caregiver, such as a doctor or a nurse. So in these cases, the two issues that I worry about, one is hallucination, kind of pulling the wrong information, but another is AI syncopancy. So basically agreeing or aligning with someone when they really should be pushing back. And that can lead people down the wrong path. Sometimes as doctors, we do have to talk with people about things that they do not want to hear, or they're not prepared to hear. And that sometimes can be tricky. Newer versions are getting better, but they are not perfect. Even the best tests, these achieve an accuracy rate anywhere from 70 to 90%, which means about 1 in 3 could really be off. In a recent study that was published that was looking at problematic responses from some of the commercially available chat tools, anywhere from between 22 to 43% of responses were in some way, shape, or form problematic, and 5 to 13% were deemed unsafe by the researchers.
So the goal here, it sounds like, is not we're going to replace our clinicians with AI agents. We're going to put these tools in their hands. Am I summing that up about right?
I think that we're going to co-evolve with AI over the next decade or so, where AI is part of the care team and part of the care process, but it is just that. It's part of a broader process. It's not a standalone service. Some of the things that we do worry about, though, in the state of Wisconsin, for example, we're expected to lose 40% of our primary care physicians to leave the workforce, mostly due to retirement over the next decade. And as we have shortages in clinician availability, I do see where AI will serve important roles. We also are seeing some interesting information where a majority of health-related queries are happening outside of clinician hours. So people are asking health-related questions outside of where doctors are traditionally in the office and available. So I think what this is telling us is that there's going to be sort of a broader imagination of the healthcare experience, but where I would like to see it is that it is part and parcel of a broader healthcare plan.
People have, I think, privacy concerns about AI coming into the healthcare setting. We know our conversations with our physician are confidential. By law, the electronic health software systems you mentioned, well, there are regulations about what they do with information. If the architecture, right, the infrastructure of this AI is from an outside company, how does that all fit in? What can they, what can't they do with that information?
For patients and families using AI tools directly, they are going to be subject to the terms and conditions and privacy policies of those tools. It's important to read carefully in the tools page, web pages about how your data are being used for training purposes or quality assurance purposes. I have an assumption that anything that a person puts into a computer may be read by another person, and it may not be used or disclosed publicly, but things that someone may not feel very comfortable having another human being know, it is not appropriate to also put that into a chat agent. On the other hand, privacy is interesting. And when we've worked with patients and we've looked at this, people who are ill or have family members who are ill prioritize getting the right answer for them or their loved one over privacy. Of course, we want the best of both. But what I mean by this is to say that I think we will see some people turning and looking for an answer and sacrificing privacy. It shouldn't be the case that one has to sacrifice it, but that could be something that we see happening. For systems that are connected to healthcare organizations that are covered under state privacy as well as federal privacy laws, patients can expect limited use of protected health information.
So I want to make very clear, the first example you were giving was if I went online and asked ChatGPT or whatever about a health condition, I probably have little expectation of privacy. That transcription AI in my doctor's office, that is more protected. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. That is correct.
And as we wrap up, Dr. Crotty, what is on the immediate horizon for you in this fast developing technology?
You know, if I had a magic wand to use AI, what it would do is it would keep everybody on track and safe as they navigate the healthcare environment. Patients and families who are challenged by the current healthcare landscape across this country, they're turning to AI to help solve their problems. They're using it for health insurance navigation. They're using them to get second opinions, and or they're using them to set expectations around a particular diagnosis or treatment. And I think the goal of any healthcare information technology is that it improves the health of the people in our population and it keeps them safe. And that's really, I think, the maturing of those two areas are, I think, the highlights of what we're going to see over the next couple of years.
Dr. Crotty, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Brooke Crotty is an internal medicine physician and interim president for Inception Health, the innovation arm of Friedrich Theta Care. She joined us to share how her organization is using artificial intelligence in healthcare. Now we're turning to some of the potential concerns that come with AI in the healthcare setting and what providers can do to protect patients. Lou He is assistant professor of healthcare informatics at UW-Milwaukee. Lou, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we just heard an example, a lot of AI use in healthcare settings. From your vantage point as a researcher, how common is the use of various kinds of AI in our healthcare?
I would say it's very common, even though my research focus is really on patients' uses, but I've attended conferences where people are presenting their findings of whether ambient AI scribes are helping physicians in terms of reducing their documentation time, reducing burnouts, etc. In terms of patient-facing applications, for example, mental health AI applications have been so widely used by patients or just the general public. And I think very recently, Utah had their very first medication scriber powered by AI. So AI has been adopted so fast, faster than what the evidence has suggested.
And I was wondering about that as a researcher, this is happening so quickly. Is the research world who wants to figure out, hey, what works and what doesn't, is it able to keep up?
Personally, I would say no, because in the research world, things move a lot slower because you have to go through rigorous studies, IRB, to ensure the research is ethic. and then peer review studies. And also the data that we have for evaluating those AI is also very limited. Oftentimes we rely on benchmark data sets that have limited settings and limited patient populations. But when those AI tools, they go into the wild, they face very diverse patient populations, very different use cases, and all kinds of scenarios may come up that we researchers in the lab settings cannot evaluate. So what researchers can tell about whether those AIs are doing well are all based on very limited data sets that we have access to.
Now, looking at this through the patient's eyes, what are some of the biggest concerns you have about this AI technology out in the wild, as you said, and the ways that people use it? What worries you? What are the biggest unanswered questions?
So, in fact, my student and I recently conducted a study, and we investigated how patients with diabetes or who are in the diagnosis process of diabetes use large language models in the wild. And we found they commonly use large language models for clinical interpretations. That is, they fed their clinical lab results to large language models and say, hey, can you interpret this? I want to get a second opinion besides what my physician tells me. And they also use large language models for nutrition and diet support. So things like make me a diabetes-friendly diet. And also they might give their large language models their self-track data generated from their wearables like Apple Health. So there are so many concerns. For example, the first is definitely, what if those AI make mistakes? Who will be responsible for those errors that may lead to severe consequences? And the second is data privacy issues, because their clinical lab results, their wearable data can pretty much tell a lot of information about a patient's well-being and overall conditions. And if the third-party commercial companies have those data, what are they going to do with those data? And the lastly is what we have seen is patient education hasn't really kept up with this increasing patient use of large language models. So we really advocate for a shift in patient education, that clinicians and patient educators need to tell patients what are safe large language model use and what are some of the risky use cases.
And so what you're describing there is, hey, I'm an individual healthcare consumer. I'm going online to the chat bot of my choice. Now, how about when doctors' offices, when medical centers are using AI as tools alongside those clinicians? I guess some of this assumes that people have the technology they need to be able to use some of these systems in place. Is that a safe assumption in Wisconsin at this point?
I would say it's definitely not a safe assumption, because oftentimes when we talk about AI use, what we often ignore is the huge technical and human infrastructure that is needed to power the AI uses, such as, do we have enough GPU? Do we have like cloud servers? Do we have the technical expertise to make sure that AI is running smoothly? Even though my research hasn't touched on this, literature has already suggested that hospitals in rural areas, in underserved areas, they're way behind in terms of AI adoption. And another thing is the patients, their own digital health literacy. Is it enough to support their safe use and smooth use of AI tools nowadays?
I know I've done, back in the day, I would do an online search for a symptom. And given the internet is what it is, I'd find a lot of scary information or potentially misleading things. Are you concerned that if people are seeing that same kind of misinformation or misleading information, but it's coming from a source that presents it with authority, as chatbots often do, do you worry that people might be more prone to be convinced, I guess, by these AI services?
Yes, I am very concerned about this. And AI tools are very good at building rapport with people, because their commercial goal is to make sure that their users stick with them. So those AI tools, they like to tell people, oh, you're correct, this is absolutely right, so that the users will keep using them. And I think this is a very risky trend, and this behavior shouldn't be supported for medical-facing AI. I think another thing is, for some patients, the AI tools might be one of their very few information sources. Well, for other patients who are more resourceful, the AI tool is one of their many information sources out of their entire care ecosystem. So there's definitely an equity issue there, because AI can say whatever they say, and some patients may reach out to people they know or clinicians, etc.
You mentioned earlier a patient education. What would you like to see? What would you like everyday people to be educated in to interact with our health system as AI is more and more a part of it?
So the first thing I observe in my own research is patient education. Human resource is very understaffed. In my research, I've seen there might only be one or two asthma educators in the entire community serving about 100 patients, for example. So I think if there are enough patient educators, they should provide adequate knowledge and information and training to patients who are navigating this increasingly complex health system, and also to provide interactive tutorial to show them when AI can be wrong and what are the consequences. And just to know that AI are not always correct, and also where they are being trained, so that patients, they don't just look at the results and say, oh, this probably makes sense, but they know about the mechanisms of how AI responded to their questions.
Lou, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lou Ha is an assistant professor of healthcare informatics at UW-Milwaukee. She's with us today to share her research on the pros and cons of artificial intelligence applications and their use in healthcare. Earlier, we heard from Dr. Brooke Crotty, an internal medicine physician and interim president for Inception Health, who shared how AI is being used in Wisconsin at Frederick Theta Care. Hey, if you've seen this in the wild as a patient, as a practitioner, I'd love to hear your experiences, what you like about these different kinds of large language model and AI apps in the healthcare setting. Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, adopting a child can feel like a roller coaster. A Wisconsin parent shares his adoption stories in a new memoir.
We felt so very blessed to wind up with our sons and to wind up with relationships with people beyond them due to adoption.
That's next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Every summer, people flock to Wisconsin's North Woods to relax, enjoy the beautiful scenery, and hopefully spot some interesting wildlife.
Writer Nancy Jorgensen reflects on a summer family trip and the search for one of the state's most iconic wild birds.
What spends every summer at a Wisconsin lake hasn't changed in a million years and is black and white and loved all over. I arrived in June at my daughter Elizabeth's Tomahawk Lake House to search for loons, for that drawn-out wail that haunts the half-light just before sunset, for that black-and-white checkered body paddling the surface before it dives below to dine. But before I could do that, Elizabeth scheduled a hike. On a nippy Minocqua morning, we set off on the Bearskin Trail. As my canvas shoes crunched over crushed gravel, I set an app to record bird calls. Elizabeth and her partner, Josh, sprang into a 3-kilometer run, but my husband, Joel, my sister-in-law, and I moseyed. More than exercise, I was interested in trees, creeks, bogs, and the pond where turtles sunbathe. I would search for loons later at the lake. As my app recorded a yellow-throat sparrow and goldfinch, I spotted a bird in flight. A black head, bill like a dagger, flat white body, and awkward webbed feet sliced through the sky. My sister-in-law lifted her binoculars. Is that a loon? Before I could answer, the loon introduced herself with a flight tremolo. Short, repetitive notes wavering quickly up and down. So fixed on the idea of loons at the lake, I never expected to spy one in the sky. It winged away before I could raise a camera, but my app confirmed its call. After the hike, back at Elizabeth's house, she dished out popcorn and Chex Mix and taught us a new card game. A writer and educator with two Wisconsin homes and a daily fitness routine, she leads a busy life. But she prioritizes family, and these weeks in Minocqua have become tradition. As she dealt a hand, I cracked the window, trading warmth for the possibility of a whale. 30 minutes later, I lost the card game, but scored a loon's slow, prolonged cry. It felt like a gift, unpredictable and perfect. "You heard one," Elizabeth said. "Now let's look for loons on the water." So, bundled in quilts, we puttered around Tomahawk Lake on her tritune. Just minutes into our ride, Joel pointed. "Loons," he whispered, and Josh slowed the boat, then stopped. We drifted, silent. Two black heads played hide-and-seek with us, bobbing and dipping, then resurfacing unexpectedly elsewhere. I didn't know that loons lay eggs in mid-May, that the chicks leave the nest within 24 hours, ready to swim. I didn't know that on June 11th, I should be alert for more than adult loons. On the next day's tritune ride, Joel pointed again, and I spotted a tiny speck floating between two checkered birds. 42 years ago, Joel and I also introduced a baby to the world. She took to it like that loonlet, curious, adventurous, and independent. That night, we watched a documentary on Wisconsin loons and discovered that, like us, they choose a summer location and return each year to the place of their hearts. After 5 days, more knowledgeable and more content, we packed for home, already planning our next visit to Tomahawk Lake. I came to the lake to hear loons and found a reminder that love roots itself in family and place. The lake, the loons, the games at a kitchen table. These are the things to be treasured, worthy of attention and care, so they will endure.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer and musician from Waukesha. This piece was produced by Sarah Hopeful. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. This is WPR News.
Adopting a child can be like a roller coaster ride. And like roller coasters, no two adoption experiences are exactly the same.
That's according to the Wisconsin author of a new memoir sharing his experiences as an adoptive parent.
Rick Parks of West Bend has lived in Wisconsin since 1999. He shares his adoption stories in his new book, Sons of Other Fathers, a memoir of adoption, identity, and the relationships that define family. Rick, thanks for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be here with you today.
You describe the adoption experience as a roller coaster, and you write that every adoption roller coaster is unique. What led you to share your story and write this memoir of your own roller coasters?
Well, our experience with adoption at the end was very, very fortunate. And there are many situations out there with people that are involved with adoption where the struggles are immense, and sometimes the outcomes can be less than what many people would have hoped. And from our perspective, we felt so very blessed to wind up with our sons and to wind up with relationships with people beyond them due to adoption, that I just felt strongly it was a story that I wanted to tell.
And as you write, you and your wife wanted to have kids, wasn't happening. What put that idea of adoption in your mind?
Well, we've been married at the time we even began to talk about this 12 years, which is perhaps beyond the time span most people would start thinking about it. But, you know, it occurred that, you know, at that point, we had not even looked into the issues that might be present with fertility. But it seemed like something we should get the wheels rolling. And if you had a natural child later on, you know, all the better, you know, the more the merrier.
Your first adoption was a closed process. For people who haven't been through adoption, what does that mean?
Well, closed adoption is really less common these days than it was 30 some years ago when we did that. But in a closed adoption, none of the parties really know who the other one is. So birth parents have no knowledge of the adoptive parents. The adoptive parents have no knowledge of the birth parents. And literally at different times in the past, these records were sealed completely. So that was kind of the norm for adoptions if you go back 30 years and even prior to that. So, you know, our first adoption was strictly just a situation where people knew people who knew people, and we were able to be connected and got a wonderful son that we have now.
Now, as an adoptive parent myself, the moment when I first laid eyes on our girls will forever etched in my mind. You'd been through a long process talking and then going through legal things and whatnot. Take us to that moment when you first met Matthew.
Well, when Matthew came to be with us, our attorney and his wife, who were friends of ours, we knew these people, pulled up in his silver Eldorado car because he was an attorney and he could afford one of those. And they brought him into our home, and there he was. It was just quite a memorable time for us.
Well, and that's really when the reality hits, right? You've been doing bureaucracy for months and months, and now here's this life in your hands.
Yeah, and for us, we try to be mentally prepared that something could go wrong. We certainly wanted to be our best to be prepared, but on some level, we had that in the back of our mind all along that, well, this might not work out. And to that extent, it became very, very real when our attorney and his wife left, and here we had our baby.
And that's a big part of the adoption process. And you write about this. There are a lot of these periods where you're waiting and you know things could go either way. And we'll talk about that. You've got a couple more adoption experiences. Waiting is just a huge part of adoption, isn't it?
It very much is. And again, there's a lot of emotional capital involved in adoption. And certainly, you want to have your heart open to be ready and to accept it and to be the best parents you can be. But as I said, there's, probably for your benefit, it's always good to just keep it in mind a little bit that this one might not go well. And if that happens, there'll be another one.
And you went into the process a second time. You weren't in Wisconsin yet, if I have this timeline right, but the prospective adoptee had been born in Wisconsin, which required a certain waiting period in a foster home. First of all, what led you to say, hey, we've been very happy with the experience with Matthew. We want to go and adopt again?
Well, for us, we both had other siblings. My wife had two sisters and a brother, and I had an older sister. And we valued the idea that you had a sibling. I mean, we were and remain very close to our siblings, and we just thought that was something we wanted for Matthew. Being older parents, you realistically, if you adopt in your mid-30s, early 40s, your children are going to be out there on their own at some point because you're not going to be around. And to have that sibling that you could say, I grew up with this guy, he's my brother, we really thought that was important.
We're talking to Rick Parks of West Bend about his new book. It's called Sons of Other Fathers, a memoir of adoption, identity, and the relationships that define family. Now, that second try at adoption you mentioned earlier, you're waiting and you're always sure that there's a possibility that might not happen. And in this case, it didn't. When you found out that this adoption wasn't going to proceed, what did that do for you and your wife?
Well, at least in our case, already having adopted Matthew and having him in our home certainly made it a little easier. And frankly, it was an incredibly quick process to be selected by this birth mother, because this was an open adoption. It was a very quick process to be selected, and she was well along to be to her delivery time. So the waiting was not extremely long by any means. So I suppose if you were ever going to have a situation where you had a change of heart after the birth of a child, this would be the one you'd want to have. It kind of rolls into all of the blessings that we've had in adoption. Even our change of heart experience was a little less crushing than many might be.
And then you ended up with the third try of bringing Kyle into your lives. And this was, again, an open process. And you have not only had contact with Kyle's birth mom for years, you eventually connected with Matthew's birth dad, even though it was a closed process. Not every adoptive parent wants that contact. Why was that important for you to do at least what you were able to do?
Well, this is one of those cases where a very good thing in one aspect can be a difficult thing in another one. And in our situation, our experience with Kyle's birth parents, and especially his birth mother, was so very, very good that as a young boy, 5 years old, Matthew noticed this, and he didn't have that in his life. And we could tell every time we got together with Kyle's birth parents, he would be a little down for a while. And you could tell it was troubling him. And then finally, one of the early parts of the book, he posed that question, why didn't my birth parents want to know me? And that was just, a gut punch for me and my wife. And it really set us to be open to the idea that maybe this mixing open and closed adoptions is not the ideal way to do this. Maybe we ought to think about, having some process of trying to connect with Matthew's birth parents as well.
And ultimately, you were able to do that. And I love throughout the book, there was, I felt like, never a sense you had of competition, right? Or, oh, they're thinking of those other parents as the real parents and we're not. This idea of embracing this wider family for your kids, can you talk about that a little?
Well, you have to have confidence that, if you're raising a child and they're with you all the days of their life, early on, of course, you've bonded with them as a parent. And, the fact that there's biological parents out there as well, did we have thoughts that might, be something that would come up, of course. And especially Matthew's birth father is just an outstanding individual, as is Kyle's birth mother. These are great, great people that you could and should admire on a lot of levels. So, there might have been a little of that in the back of your mind, but, for the good of your child, you do what you need to do.
Now, knowing that the adoption roller coaster can take a lot of unexpected twists and turns, and it's going to be different and it will follow different paths than yours did. If a prospective parent says to you, hey, I'm thinking about adoption, you've written a book about it, what advice would you give them as they start in that process?
Well, I would tell them to be prepared for the roller coaster to shift. This might not go entirely as planned. You have to have that in the back of your mind while, as I said earlier, still opening your heart up that we want to be parents to a child. We want to, bring a child in and give them all our love and all our support. But certainly be prepared if things don't go according to plan, and then be committed to we'll get back on the roller coaster and try again.
Rick, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
That was Rick Parks from West Bend. His new book is called Sons of Other Fathers, a memoir of adoption, identity, and the relationships that define a family. Well, if you're an adoptive parent like Rick or like me, you probably have a story to share. We'd love to hear about it, your experiences with the adoption process, what good came out of it, the challenges you faced along the way, and the advice you'd have for other people going through the adoption process. Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that email, wisconsintoday@wpr.org, with your adoption stories. Weeks back on the show, we met the Barrio Dance Group, a Wisconsin team that made an appearance on America's Got Talent.
And we invited you to share your experiences with community dance organizations. Greg sent us an email about a social dance club in the village of Whiting in Portage County.
Quoting from Greg's email, there's a Whiting Dinner and Dance Club that's been active since 1929. It currently has about 100 members. There are 5 dances per year, most with live bands providing the music. Formal wear, strongly encouraged. My wife and I have been members, Greg says, since 1996.
Oh, how fun, Greg. Thanks so much for sharing that.
How about you? If you get together in a local dance group for fun or competition, tell us about it.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us. Either way, that number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.